Good evening and welcome back to Editing Aloud. Thanks for joining us. I have with me, as always, a panel of sparkling journalists with many views on the economy, which this week has taken a turn for, has not taken a turn for the worse so much as has proved to be pretty terrible even before we went into the corona crisis. Lucanio, GDP figures for the first quarter of this year showing the economy contracted by 2% just in the first quarter. That's the third negative quarter we've had in a row, and that's before the lockdown really began in earnest. So what does it signal about the rest of this year?
Well, Hillary, I think you've summed it up quite nicely there. I mean, I think what we're seeing here is the impact of what we didn't do before.
I'm going to move to Rob because we've lost you. Rob, what are you seeing for this year, given that we have minus 2% for the first quarter? I mean, is this more of a catastrophe than you expect, less of a catastrophe than you expect? What does it look like?
Hillary, the first quarter GDP numbers that came out only included a few days of the lockdown. So we haven't really seen the impact of the full lockdown on the economy. And the second quarter is bound to be terrible. I mean, the figures I've read range up to 30%. I mean, so it's going to be a disaster. So I think the implication is that for government to meet Treasury's target of 7.2% contraction this year, that even seems too optimistic at this point. I mean, I think that, you know, it includes a whole lot of expectations that things are going to recover far quicker than they will. And we've certainly seen in the States and elsewhere that things don't recover as quickly as you expect. And as infections keep rising all over the world, I think, you know, the U.S. had 47,000 yesterday, a record. You know, the economies don't recover like people wanted to and like a lot of economists have factored into their models.
Rob, as we were discussing just before the show, Paul Krugman, the New York Times columnist, writing today that the evidence from the States is that there in fact isn't such a trade-off between lives and the economy, between the health and the economic issues, and that if you don't attend to the health issues, you are going to get the economy shutting down again. I mean, do we face something like that in South Africa as we reopen the economy?
Yes, I mean, absolutely we face the same issues. I think we can take our lead from other countries that have been there and done that and are now facing that kind of quandary. If we open too quickly, like to some extent we are doing, then we could face massive economic consequences as a result. But on the other hand, you know, unlike in the States, we haven't been able to get real relief to people. So we needed to open our economy. I think some of the projections say that we're back up to sort of 80-90% of pre-lockdown levels already. So the consequence, we needed to get the economy going, but there will be ructions, there'll be bounces, it'll be messy.
Lucanio, back to you. This question of how much relief has actually been provided, support has been provided to cushion people from the impact of the crisis. You've been running stories on your front pages this week about the unemployment insurance fund, which is simply not reaching the people who need it. I mean, is that some symptomatic of a sort of a broader failure in the government's response?
I would totally agree, Hillary. I mean, I think the number, like we always write about as journalists, is 500 billion. But then, as we know, 200 billion of that is supposed to be the credit guarantee scheme. And as far as, and I think the last numbers we got from the finance minister on that was about 10 billion had actually been put out.
Lucanio, you've been running this week on your front pages in Business Day with stories about the unemployment insurance fund not delivering the kind of relief that it should to the people who need it, to cushion them from the crisis. Just tell us a bit about what's been happening at the UIF. But does this symbolize a sort of a broader failure in government to deliver the stimulus and the relief that has been promised?
Yeah. No, Hillary, I mean, I think broadly speaking, as Rob was saying earlier, like, I mean, the issue here, like the fact that we haven't been able to get enough money to people all at the right time as compared to what you've seen, say, in other places like the US and the UK, has sort of weakened the support for the whole lockdown scenario. And I think that the UIF situation is actually quite serious, because that's supposed to be the sort of like, no, the main tool for distributing money to people. And what you've had, this nagging, like technical faults. I think, like, it's some strange things, really, because I think what happened this week, basically, and people were trying to claim for June could not, because the system was wrong and it was putting out personal information. So that meant that millions of people could not access it. And then what had happened before, we had problems before where there are something like a million people who haven't been able to access this from the word go because they were not registered properly. And you know, you get taken from pillar to post. The minister blames the employers blame the UIF. It's been, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, a million people who haven't had any income since end of March still, I mean, no wonder, like, you know, like, it's really a struggle to keep the national consensus around it. But
yeah, we've been running in the Sunday Times, actually, with a story about fraud, alleged fraud, fraudulently paid UIF amounts to the wrong people in really, really very large amounts. So it seems to be a technical problem with the fund, but also a possible corruption problem. So now that means the 40 billion that is supposed to be getting to people in terms of the UIF coronavirus related scheme is not getting there. That's a piece of your 500 billion relief package. How much of the rest of it is getting there, Lucanio?
I mean, like, Daniel, Warren and I actually had a chat with Daniel Minella earlier from APSA, where we actually questioned him on specifically on the credit guarantee scheme. And we sort of know from the official, even there, the numbers were a bit confusing. I think a few weeks back, we had the Deputy Governor of Reserve Bank, Kobe Naidu, said, gave us a number that indicated maybe something like 13 billion, like just on the massive base, what he was saying. Then Warren did a story of like talking to the banks themselves, and the number was closer to like 2 billion. And then in the budget last week, the finance minister said 10 billion is gone. But even then, I mean, if you think about it, initially that program was supposed to be 100 billion, maybe going up to 200. So it's only like 10 billion, that's only like 10%. And that 200 billion is supposed to be a big chunk of an overall 500 billion stimulus or relief package. As we know, a lot of that, of the other 300 billion, is actually about, I think 130 billion is about moving budgets rather than creating new expenditure. So it's a bit of a problem. Like, you know, if you think you close down the economy and the only way, you know, to have some kind of relief was to actually get these things working, and it's not very clear how well they're working. Even though, to be fair, on the UIF, it's not the whole 40 billion that hasn't gone. I think 26 billion or something has actually gone to people. So there has been relief out there, but obviously, like, in terms of the need and in terms of the suffering that we've had, like, in terms of, we've seen the numbers from the economy, we've seen how many jobs were lost even before COVID hit. So you can imagine how many jobs have been lost since April, when you were basically closed the whole thing. And yeah, it's quite bad that we've been able to get these things working. And this is like 3 or 4 months since the lockdown.
I'm actually wondering whether even now with the reopening, we're not going to see a whole wave of retrenchments as people open up and then realize there is no demand. And Warren, I actually wanted to ask you, how is this loan guarantee scheme supposed to work? I mean, who is it supposed to address and what is it going to do? And the finance minister did mention in last week's budget speech that they were looking to revise some of the provisions of the scheme to enable it to be more helpful in the recovery. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, sure, Hilary. So the initial conditions still remain in place. It applies to businesses with turnover of 300 million rand per annum or less. And in terms of the loan itself, the loan is a loan at prime interest rate that the banks take the first 6% of losses. And any other losses they take, they then submit a claim and effectively the state through the National Treasury and the SOB redeems them for those losses.
So they are have a government guarantee to lend to small and medium-sized businesses.
Correct. Existing clients that then apply for what they call these COVID-19 loans on the same basis, in the same credit vetting process as any other loan that their banker would offer them. But the idea is certainly to get the money out as quickly as possible. And there are a couple of factors that have played into the reasons why it's been taken up so slowly. One of them was that, and again, we spoke to Daniel Minella from APSA today, who reiterated this, was the large amount of relief that the banks and the large amount of relief and restructuring that the banks had provided to their customers prior to the inception of the COVID-19 loans. So if you looked at Nedbank, for instance, in the 5 weeks between the start of the lockdown and the end of April, they restructured roughly 10% of their entire loan book, equivalent to about 81 billion rand in the space of the 5 weeks. The COVID-19 loans only came into effect in about the middle of May. So despite that, despite the large amount of relief and restructuring, the view is that it's still been very slow in the take-up. And one of the other reasons that has been forwarded for that is because business owners were being very cautious and didn't want to take on more debt. They would rather look at cost-saving initiatives to reduce costs as opposed to taking on more debt. So the net effect, though, is that we're still looking at roughly 40% of the president's fiscal stimulus package that is being, I'd say, fairly significantly underutilized.
Hillary, just on the loan guarantee thing, I think it's totally unacceptable what has happened there. The point of it was to get money out to small businesses in an emergency situation. The banks are using the same credit vetting procedures as normal, only now the prospects for the companies are worse. So people are less likely to get loans, even though the losses are ultimately backed by the government. It's an utter failure. It's a failure of conception and execution by the banks and the policymakers. It's just one of the many, many complete screw-ups we've had in this entire thing.
I mean, it seems to be in the design of the scheme where policymakers insisted that the banks had to be almost as prudent as they would be normally. But if that were the case, as Warren's pointing out, they were happy to give relief and restructure debts for people in any case if the customers were that good and they had just to apply the same criteria. So what is it, Rob, that's gone wrong in this whole process?
It's this massive miscommunication partly between government and the private sector. Government expected banks to lend out to businesses that were severely troubled. And the banks thought, well, we've got this extra thing, but we still have to apply our normal procedures. So there were different expectations on both sides. And between that, the customers have just fallen by the wayside. The stories you hear of companies who've applied for this and the bureaucracy even of applying for these loans is a nightmare, never mind the actual fact that so many people wouldn't qualify who were meant to qualify according to government's expectations. That's one of the many reasons why you can't say this is a 500 billion rand stimulus.
Let's go back to that loan guarantee scheme, Lucanio. So now the government has guaranteed these loans. So what should have happened is that the government says to the banks, take risk. Lend to companies who might or might not make it. Take more risk than you would otherwise. Then you'd expect a higher probability of default on those loans, right? Then the government would have to stand good for the guarantee. So what I'm asking you, Lucanio, is the government good for that guarantee? Is it anywhere in the budget? Is there any provision for the banks to, in fact, take those kinds of risks to lend to small and medium companies?
Yeah. I think, Hillary, that's been one of the fundamental problems with this. Like as Rob mentioned, you've got a lot of misconceptions, but also miscommunication. I mean, I think for a lot of people thought, okay, this is what's going to happen. You go to the bank and you ask for whatever. It doesn't. Then the bank gives it to you, and then the bank doesn't worry about it because the loss will be covered. But then on the other hand, the banks have been told, you know, you still have to be prudent. You can't just throw money away.
Don't take too many risks.
Yeah, exactly. So that if I say, Hillary, you can lend to Warren, and then when you come and Warren defaults and you come to me again, then I say, but Hillary, but you were like a bit reckless in lending to Warren. Didn't you know that he'd lost his job or whatever, you know? So the banks, like, they then have to, like, keep their conservative criteria because, you know, that 6% loss could easily then become 100% loss, you know? Because it's not a guarantee as in the way that people understand the guarantees. It comes with a lot of conditions, a lot of conditionality.
Are you saying that the government guarantee is not, in fact, a government guarantee? In which case, I don't blame the banks for not lending.
I mean, Warren will answer this close better than me, but I think that it is a guarantee. But then I think as a bank, you can't then afford to be seen to have been reckless in lending out the money. I think that's where the problem is. So there is an incentive for the banks then to be conservative. Because if the people default, and then at some point the Treasury says, NetBank or First Rand, sorry, I'm like, no, you shouldn't have lent to that person. You should have known that they were like, or whatever. You should have, you know, so you know your criteria. You know your criteria, and therefore they defaulted. It's not our problem.
Rob, just looking a little bit more broadly than the loan guarantee scheme, that's one of the big components of the relief package. What about the rest of it? Is there enough there to sort of almost keep businesses in business to support a recovery? I mean, what does the recovery now look like?
Well, Hillary, as you mentioned before, Paul Krugman wrote a lot about this, about how you basically put your economy into the ice. You put it in a coma, and then you provide money to keep businesses alive, and then you can take them out of the coma when demand surfaces again. So the issue is that there isn't enough money in this economy, as we saw in the budget last week, to keep everyone at 100% of where they were in the first place. The other issue is that you can support it for a while, but you can't support it forever. So demand isn't there, as you mentioned before. So companies are going back to opening up to some extent, but like you say, the demand isn't there. So companies are realizing that it wasn't just wait 3 months and you go back to normal. So this is another consequence for the banks, I think, is that not just these loans they're currently lending out, but what happens to the other money they've lent to other clients and those same clients beforehand. They stand to lose that as well. So I think the wider ramifications of this, you know, nobody quite understands how it's going to impact us all, but it's going to be a lot worse than anyone expected.
Rob, your cover story on the Financial Mail this week on auditors and the role that they've played. You know, what has prompted the cover story? What do you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, I mean, Warren actually wrote it, but it's essentially this advocacy company called Open Secrets has done this report assessing the role of auditors in South Africa and the need for reform, given the fact that we have had little accountability for some of the heinous collapses. You know, you can think of Steinhoff, Tongaat, you can think of VBS, where the auditor was actually arrested last week in the VBS case. And the real issue has been the lack of accountability when we have auditing errors. We see this at Steinhoff too, where Steinhoff has paid massive amounts to PwC to clean up the mess created by another one of the big four auditors. So it's about the need for reform, essentially. And we've seen in the UK at the end of last year, Lord Brydon released his report talking about how we should close the expectation gap. What people want from auditors is they want some kind of assurance that these companies aren't just doing bad things and we're going to have massive frauds, but the auditors themselves don't think that's their job. So the issue is, I suppose, closing the expectation gap between what the public wants from auditing companies and what they're ultimately getting. I mean, Warren could speak more to that, but I suppose that's the reform that is hitting our country right now.
Well, at least some reform is hitting our country. Warren, what is happening in the auditing profession, and is it responding to some of the concerns, the many concerns that have arisen both locally and globally about auditing as a profession?
Yes, certainly they have. Talking to Lawazi Bam at Deloitte and Mark Stewart at BDO just yesterday, Hillary, they are certainly aware of the damage that's being done to the audit industry and its reputation. And as Rob alluded to, the Brydon report in the UK is a very timeous and I think comprehensive review of the audit industry and how it needs to reform and adapt to restore the integrity. And I think what everyone's saying is that auditing is actually a public service undertaking. It is something for the benefit of the public, for the consumers of financial information, and now's the time to kind of make some of these very tough decisions around how do we restore this professional skepticism and the independence of auditors undertaking their work. And funny enough, I mean, some of the themes are themes we've traversed many years ago, like you would have been familiar with the collapse of Arthur Andersen following the Enron scandal, where questions were asked about how independent and objective can an auditor be when the consulting arm of the business is making millions of dollars providing consulting services to the company that you're auditing. So many of these things are things we're revisiting from the past, but certainly on the local scene, at the very least, there's a recognition that there needs to be reform, and everyone needs to get together and have some very hard negotiations about what to do to improve the quality of our audits.
Look,
I wonder if I can add something on that. More of a question. I suppose this has become quite a worldwide story as well recently. I mean, with the story with Wirecard in Germany EY. I mean, how amazing is that? I mean, I read something in the FT that said that at some point the auditors never even looked at something as basic as bank statements, apparently. I'm not saying this is a fact, so I hope they don't try to sue me, but there's something I read in the FT. I mean, how amazing is that? You think there should be some kind of basic, minimum standards, you know?
Absolutely. I think that Wirecard is a story that's been brewing, I think, for a while. And, it's broken properly, in the last few weeks. And one of the first things that's happened is that one of the first lawsuits have been served against EY already in that situation. And just kind of, again, reiterates the problems that we've had in the audit industry around the world. I mean, you saw in places like India, PwC got banned for a couple of years because of problems with audits and these type of things. So I think the article's timeless, and we hope it continues the debate around what needs to happen.
Let me move, Rob Rose, let me move from the auditors to the companies they audit. Results this week from Naspers, which did this hugely complex deal last year and is as much of the JSE index as it ever was. Naspers doing just fabulously. Some of our local companies doing just terribly. I mean, what is the pattern that you're seeing in the kind of corporate statements now? Well, Harry, and what is it telling us?
It is interesting. Partly, I think it's because Naspers and Prosus are in a good space in terms of industries. I mean, there's 1.6 billion gamers who spent a lot of time at home in the last couple of months. And so that certainly benefits Naspers. Also, they're digital. And they're right at the forefront of the e-commerce wave, which is really taking off now. So I think that in terms of their particular unique market, it's a really good one. And that's partly why Naspers' share price on the JSE has risen 34% this year. But we see other companies like Mr. Price, for example, selling their overseas operations and coming back home and betting on the South African economy. And sorry, for the many reasons you've spoken about in the first session that Lucanio spoke about and you mentioned, We I think it's a very risky move to put all your eggs in the South African basket right now. The economy is really, I would say we might have even have tumbled over that fiscal cliff. So I just think it's a very risky thing for Mr. Price to do.
Lucanio, what are you seeing in the sort of pattern of company results and announcements hitting business day? What is it telling us about what the sort of corporate landscape looks like now?
Well, I mean, clearly, I wouldn't be meant to give anybody financial advice, but I definitely wouldn't be buying any property stocks if I was buying any today. the numbers for them, obviously, the weak consumer demand we had even before. Now you had COVID, now you've got your company's not actually paying rent, and you don't know how many of those will come back, as we were saying earlier with this thing about the livelihood and lives, the fact that you're opening up the economy doesn't necessarily mean people are going to go back to the shops, because people are I think there's quite, people can actually be quite fearful. I was telling just Warren earlier this anecdote of my own, where I went to my local shopping mall there, and I saw, my hairdresser is back, and I was like, I was quite relieved for them that they managed to survive, and they're still in business. But I still didn't go in and have my hair cut because I'm still, because the next day you read the financial mail about how the numbers of COVID infections and Gauteng are shooting up the roof. And then I think, do I really then want to go and have my hair cut? So you're going to have this situation. So that's kind of when property is probably going to struggle for a while, I would think. And a lot of our retailers are still going to remain under pressure. I mean, I think e-commerce, as you mentioned, process, Naspers, I think that's probably going to be, they would put in the lone bright spot for a while.
We've got actually a couple of minutes left. And in those couple of minutes, I want to give each of you really a 30-second chance to say, what do you think is going to be the biggest structural shift that we're going to come out of the crisis with? Lucanios, you first.
Structural shift. Oh, we'll be staying at home more. And actually, maybe I might become a gamer. No, I'm not.
You're going to stay home and be a gamer. Warren, biggest sort of structural permanent shift. Very quickly, out of this crisis.
Well, yeah, I think the home office. I think the home office is going to be a big factor. There's going to be a lot more money. I think Builders Warehouse has been busy every time I've seen it. So I think there's going to be a lot of reinvestment into homes
into
and
staying
home offices.
At home. Rob, long term shift.
Digital is going to be, especially shopping and retail. That's where it's at.
How do they cut your hair digitally?
On that note, please join us again next week for another edition of Editing Aloud. And meanwhile, stay safe.